focusing on this question of how do we bridge the gap, I'd like to really challenge you that we haven't really talked about what the problem really is. If you actually listen to the debate nationally over the last, several weeks, and particularly this week, we're not even talking about the problem. So if we actually want to solve it, I think we have to become far more blunt about what it is we're trying to solve. And I know there's a lot of concern about, well, yes, but you can't be alarmist and you can't do this and you can't do that. But unless you actually start to talk about the real issues, then we're never going to get to the right solutions. So I'd like to just cover quickly a few things you probably already know, but I think it's just worthwhile revisiting. If you then want to come up with a suggestion about how you're going to actually bridge this gap. This is a much bigger problem than just climate. We know that we need about 1.5 planets to live on today in terms of biophysical capacity, on average. If we all lived at US levels, it's about 5 planets. I think Australia is about 4, and so it goes on. What we're seeing is because of the combination of population times consumption, we now have the convergence of a whole range of critical issues, most of which are well known to you. I mean, the peak oil issue, the climate itself, water, food, the financial crisis and social instability is actually the same linked set of issues. And they're all symptoms of the fact that what we're doing is currently completely unsustainable. So we have to find some way out of this. What we have, I would suggest, is a fundamental institutional failure around the world, where we no longer have organisations that are actually capable of looking at long-term issues and coming up with solutions. We have allowed the system we're working under, whether it's politically or corporately, and indeed to some extent socially, to focus now on such short-term perspectives that we can't come to grips with these real long-term issues. And I think Gillian Tett in the Financial Times in London summarised it quite well at the end of last year. She was talking initially in the context of the GFC, but the point she was making at the time was a much broader one, which I totally agree with. Looking at climate, just a little bit of history, which you probably know, but it's worth refreshing our memory. We have emerged over the course of the Holocene, which is that little blip right over on the right-hand side of about 10,000 years. This goes back 60 million years or so. And what we now have is a climate where the average temperature is about 0.6 degrees C higher than the peak through the Holocene period. What we've probably already committed to is a 2 degrees C temperature increase, which if you look at it back in geological time, puts us back at the point where the glaciation of the Northern Hemisphere actually started. You see the red arrow on there, actually. I won't go through all this, I haven't got time. If you look at what we're currently doing in terms of current policies, it puts us back to the point where implication of that is about a 4 degrees C temperature increase, which puts us back to the glaciation of the Antarctic way back, essentially, after the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, that red peak. You can read all this up in Jim Hansen's papers if anybody's interested, and you probably have. But the point I'd quite simply make is that the 2 degrees C temperature increase, which we probably already committed to, implies a sea level increase of 6 to 7 metres. And the 4 degrees C temperature increase, which is the direction we're headed in, is about a 70 metre sea level increase. Now, that 2 degrees C is enough to really wipe out London, New York, Shanghai, Tokyo in their current form. And if you're talking about 4 degrees C, then obviously that has major ramifications for humanity in terms of the current structure of our civilization. So this is not stuff that's coming through in the national debate or indeed internationally in any of the sort of official forums. You say, okay, well, that's all alarmist stuff, and we've heard a lot of that this week from Nick Minchin and others, I guess, and also from, I guess, some on the climate action side saying, look, you really can't afford to scare the horses. You need to be careful how you handle this. I actually think that's been one of the biggest strategic mistakes that's been made in this entire debate, is we haven't been honest about what the problem really is. And if you look... And if you want backup to that, then just look at the evidence that we're now seeing in the Arctic. This is a picture from Pymas in Washington, University of Washington. The diagram, the lines there are basically every month over the last period from 79 to 2010. The lower line is the hottest month in September, where the melt is greatest, and the top line is the middle of winter, February. And you can see that the finer lines there are the trend lines, fitted to that actual data. Now, what that's really saying is if the current trends continue, which they may not, but if they do, then we're ice-free in summer by 2015 in the Arctic, and we're ice-free all year by 2030. Now, that may not happen, but if you're talking about risk management, you would be very stupid to ignore the evidence that's right in front of our eyes. Jim Hansen's picture of the way that the world has warmed over the last four decades, I think, hits you right between the eyes. I mean, quite clearly, things are moving very quickly, particularly in the Arctic, which is warming 2 to 3 times faster than the rest of the world. We're told that warming stopped in 1998. One of the graphs, I think, in the documentary last Thursday showed a picture of ocean heat content more or less static. Very interesting. The reality is this picture. And the reason for the difference is that a large part of the statistics of the bottom sections of the ocean were actually left out of the picture that Nick Minchin was actually showing. Warming has not stopped. It has stopped atmospherically, or it's slowed down, shall we say, and on land, but the ocean is still heating extremely rapidly. And that's going to have significant ramifications very quickly. If you look at the speed of our emissions build-up, it's far faster than even occurred in the PETM discontinuity 56 million years ago. The big risk I think we face is the Arctic permafrost, where we have substantially more carbon secured than in the atmosphere, and certainly more than we've emitted since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Quite how fast that's going to come out, there's a lot of scientific debate on. But once it starts moving, there's not very much you can actually do about it. So we have to face reality, and I don't think that is really happening in the debate in any section at the present time. I won't go through all of these, but I can give you graphs or pictures showing back up to all of those points. And that's a very, very big change from, I think, the official view. If we keep on doing what we're currently doing, we're headed for about a 4 degrees C temperature increase. That's on the new policies, including our clean energy package and the other policies developed around the world. Now, people sort of rather glibly say, well, look, you know, that's fine, it's not a big issue. And the IEA themselves and the World Energy Outlook say, look, if we don't do something soon, we're going to end up where we're headed, and that's not very pleasant. So what does it actually really mean? Well, the Royal Society was pretty blunt about it, is that our ability to adapt to that is going to become increasingly limited. John Schellenhuber from Potsdam was even more blunt, the bottom line being that the 4 degrees C world basically means we have a reduction in population from 7 billion to 1 billion. Because of the impact on agriculture, the change in sea level, and so on. Now, that is not something you hear talked about publicly. Yes, it sounds scary stuff, and I guess it is. But the fact is, unless we start to really confront that and we pay attention, then we're not going to get the solutions. And this is really risk management. So we have to avoid 4 degrees C at all costs. What are we doing? Very little. Human emissions, as I think Anna said, are continuing in the worst case. We're the highest emitter virtually in the world, apart from Qatar and Saudi Arabia. If you add in our exports, we're going to end up being fourth or fifth largest carbon emitter in the world, and I think that's probably an underestimate from more recent material I've seen. We actually have about 1 billion tonnes of CO2 we can continue to emit before we use up our total amount if we wish to stay below 2 degrees C. And in fact, a fair bit of that's already gone. This was since 2000. Our budget runs out in about 7 years. The global budget runs out in roughly 20 years. We can't afford to emit essentially the fossil fuels we already have if we want to stay within that budget. So it raises a question why we're continuing to do it and what value do we place on actually on fossil fuel companies, and this is one of the big issues that's going to come in, I think. And if you look at perspectives on climate change, most of the debate is taking place on the left-hand side of that diagram, in the popular press and even the IPCC itself. The really important bit is on the right-hand side, and that's not considered to be a reasonable discussion ground. But that's what this problem is really all about. So essentially, the official solutions are not working. Rushing from coal to gas is going to worsen warming, not improve it. Carbon capture and storage is not going to work in the time or to the extent required. It may work in limited circumstances. Clean coal, well, is really an oxymoron. It's not clean. And high carbon infrastructure we're putting in place today is going to lock in our emission profile basically for the next 50 years. The alternatives, there are plenty of them. In particular, efficiency and conservation, which is the bit of the Cinderella. I won't go through all the others, you know them full well. But the fact is we have to move to them far more rapidly than we're currently doing. And if we use conventional development processes, it's not going to happen. Because most of these things take if you look at the history since World War II, at least 30-odd years to become material, in other words, say, representing 1% of the total energy demand we have. Somehow you have to actually speed that up. So we have really little choice but to move to an emergency response if we're serious about trying to do something about it. And those are the sorts of initiatives we really got to take to achieve that. We need something like a Marshall Plan, an Apollo project and so on to address the issue. In terms of governance, we need to be honest, I think, in facing the real challenge. In my view, conventional politics and business is not capable of actually handling this. We're reaching the limits of what Western democracy can actually contend with, and we're going to have to rethink it. I think that means that certain key issues like climate, resource scarcity, are in some way going to have to be set outside politics with a system of global governance, which is not the same thing as global government, which a lot of the, I think, right-wing think tanks have paroxysms over periodically. So the gap, in terms of bridging the gap, I think we need to be honest about the risks and the time frame we have to respond in. We need to change the context of the debate. We need to build a coalition which is really going to focus on champions who are committed and prepared to speak out. It's got to involve community, activist groups, progressive NGOs, and I have to say that I think the main NGOs in this country have failed because they have been prepared to back off being honest about the problem and work within the government tent, and that means you can only talk on the government's terms. There are progressive corporates, particularly in the insurance industry and institutional investors. We need the military involved because this becomes issues of national security, and they are very concerned about that. There are levels of government, particularly local, who will respond, and in particular international institutions. If you look around the world, the IEA, the International Energy Agency, the OECD, the IMF, the UN, are all making the same comments that we need to move to a completely different path of development. So the other issues there, I think I won't go into in detail, apart from the fact that this does become a national security issue, and it hasn't been pitched in that sense, I think, at all so far. So in summary, this is not, despite any thoughts you might have otherwise, a gloom and doom story, but if we want to avoid catastrophic outcomes, we really do have to start acknowledging the facts. And this does provide our key opportunity, I think, to actually break out of the fossil fuel straitjacket. John Maynard Keynes, I think, said the difficulty is not, lies not in the new ideas, but in escaping from the old ones, and that's exactly the problem we're in at this present time.